This is an ABC podcast.
Malo lele, kia ora na koutou katoa toa and good morning. I'm your host, Eggy Dubow, and this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We'd like to acknowledge that Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, today on the show, have you ever heard of the South Pacific Defence Ministers meeting? Well, you will today, because it's in its 10th year, and we'll discuss this upsurge of interest in the Pacific. Also, deep sea mining sees more activists out on the waters, but are being warned to stop being reckless. And HIV cases in Papua New Guinea are rising at an alarming rate. Stay tuned for more on these stories. Again, I'm Eggy Dubow and this is Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Firstly, climate activists have praised the creation of a new loss and damage fund and the increased commitments towards renewable energy at the UN climate talks in the United Arab Emirates. But despite these gains, there's concerns around progress in reducing carbon emissions. One of the leading Pacific voices at COP28 in Dubai was the Prime Minister of Tonga, Siausi Sovaleni, and he joins us now on the line from New Zealand. With that, I say malo e tau mau pongpongini, Mr. Prime Minister.
Malo e lele. Very good morning.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this morning. I understand you have just returned from Dubai. And do you rate COP28 as a success for Pacific countries, and why?
Well, from the previous COP, I think this is one of the more productive COP, basically because we translated some of the plans into action and secured some resources.
And can I ask, what are some of those resources that you were able to secure?
On the coalition for prosperity, we managed to actually get about $225 million. That's $100 million from peso fund and about $125 million from the CHEF facilities. And basically, this is about effectively managing the oceans in the Pacific, that is, and protecting about 30% of that, and also looking at healthy, productive people. Especially looking at the food system that we have, which relied a lot on the ocean. And lastly, a fit-for-purpose financing, looking at sustainable mechanism to support the Blue Pacific strategy. Yeah. At the same time, we highlighted the resilient facility that we have, which is, well, we currently have like $50 million for that one, which is basically to look at the adaptive measures that Pacific Islands would like to actually put in place, but we are hoping to actually have more donation into this particular fund, which we are aiming to operationalize by the Tonga forum meeting in late August.
Thank you for that, Prime Minister. Look, before we do get into that Blue Pacific Prosperity initiative, besides, the loss and damage fund, it was actually signed off on the first day of talks. Was that actually a good thing for the Pacific?
Great thing for the Pacific. I mean, people are talking about the climate effects, but we're already experiencing it in the Pacific. We have, cyclones that are more, in a few years back, we have huge cyclones after every 10 years. But recently, we're having Category 4, Category 5 cyclones in the Pacific every second or third year. So sea level rising forces some of the villages to move inland. So the loss and damage facility can actually help rebuild some of the damages due to the climate change effect.
And when now we can come back to that Blue Pacific Prosperity Initiative. Again, it's secured already $225 million in donations from private partners. What then would be the main aim of this initiative, though?
Well, basically, to operationalize it, looking at the governance, looking at the operation eligibility conditions and the processes by the PIFS meeting or the Pacific Leaders meeting come August, end of August next year. But the main thing is to actually educate our population about how do we sustainably manage our ocean and actually promoting, SMAs and what have you to actually reach the 30% target that we have under this initiative. One of the other I guess, important recognition is the fit for purpose financing, and that basically need a whole range of partners, not just private sectors, NGOs, but looking for others who actually have an interest in maintaining and sustaining a healthy ocean.
When you talk about fit for purpose, though, Prime Minister, are you expecting that this would be something that all Pacific nations would sign on to this initiative?
Well, I mean, in the Pacific leaders meeting in Rarotonga a month ago, all the leaders supported that initiative. So we part of the declaration is just basically showing that we all support doing something more about managing our ocean.
Would there be anything, though, that may stop them from joining in on this initiative?
Resources, available resources will be something that will be crucial. And this $225 million will go a long way in addressing some of the concerns. Because, I mean, like, we have a huge ocean. Take, for example, Tonga. It's 99% ocean and 1% land. And we already have issues with IUU, and the fact that we have a huge issues with IUU basically recognize the fact that we don't have the resources to actually manage and monitor a huge part of our ocean. And having this the resources, for example, that $225 million will go a long way in actually helping us maintain a healthy oceans.
From where we're standing at the moment, though, are you worried about Tonga's ability to finance climate adaptation and resilience in the future? Because, I mean, what are the biggest expenses you foresee Tonga facing?
I'm always worried about lack of resources. I mean, we have issues with, say, resilience. For example, we are actually reallocating a big part of our AIDA or the World Bank budget into building resilience in schools, because we do believe that we need to invest in the resilience of education and health. But for example, in education, the last couple of cyclones took us about 2 years to recover from it, whereby students actually studied under a tent or even under a tree, basically for about 2 years. So the disrupted learning to this generation, it's a huge, it will have a huge impact on our development. And if we can invest in making sure that the schools are safer, then we can minimize the possibility of disrupted learning for our students. So there's always a need to actually do something, whether it's adaptation or mitigation, but we need to prioritize given the lack of resources that we have. So the pledges or the commitment by some of these partners will go a long way in actually building our resilience, getting us a little bit more ready for the effect of climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we are well known that the Pacific is on the front line of climate change, and also the impacts of global warming are being most severely felt in our region. But do you feel the rest of the world, especially world leaders, are actually listening and paying attention to the Pacific when you're attending global forums like this, like COP28, sorry?
Well, I do believe that there's a changing attitude. We have seen a huge number of donations and commitment from some of our some of the countries in COP, and pledges that we didn't know will happen even like 5 years ago. Take for example the loss and damage. You know, I have to give credit to Tuvalu. They've been talking and raising it since the Paris Agreement. And now we actually have more than $500 million commitments so far to that particular fund. The Coalition for Prosperity was just basically set up and endorsed by the forum last month, and now we got $225 million. So to me, there's a changing attitude, and people actually realize that we are facing the brunt of climate change, and they're trying to actually help us out. It's about us actually stepping up and continue the advocacy, and at the same time make sure that we are prioritizing what we want and actually working closer with these partners.
Mm. Prime Minister, as we stay and stick to the Loss and Damage Fund, are you aware, though, that Australia has signed up to the initiative? And is it an important thing for Australia to be part of the scheme?
I do believe that everybody should be part of the scheme because, I mean, this is not the effect of climate change. It's not limited to the Pacific or to Tonga. I mean, it's a global phenomena that actually have impact on everybody. Which is why the Pacific actually support this idea of actually trying to keep the Pacific Ocean healthy, because that's our contribution to this global fight that we have against climate change.
I do want to know, though, what's your view about Dubai hosting this year's COP, because we understand that, you know, the UAE is one of the biggest fossil fuel producers in the world. Did it make sense for COP to be held there, though?
To me, with my experience, it was a great COP. I mean, Dubai did a great job with the loss and damage. They initiated, a contribution to the Loss and Damage Fund. So I'm fine with what the Dubai, with Dubai hosting the event, given their experience and given the resources they're putting in into some of the key initiatives that we have.
Again, with the Pacific countries who are, you know, asking and pushing to eliminate fossil fuels, again, did it gain much traction while you were there in Dubai? I mean, did it affect any of the negotiations?
Well, it's ongoing, but it's something that was in the agenda, which is a good thing, and where we are hoping to actually get something that the parties actually agreed on come next week.
Well, Prime Minister, I do want to ask, moving forward, what are the other expectations you were hoping, or any other gains that came out of COP28?
I mean, we are very happy that renewable energy is taking some limelight with the pledges to actually triple our use of renewable energy. Tonga, for example, have a very ambitious target of 100% renewable by 2030. To some extent, we are helping, but given the size of the Pacific, it's probably not in the scale that we wanted, but we want to show the world that we are there with them in this fight against climate change. At the same time, I have to commend Dubai for putting education and health in the agenda of COP28. Before, it used to be something that we discussed. COP used to be a technical discussion. But with health and education being introduced in the agenda, that's to me, it's a big step forward. Understanding the impact of climate change on education, understanding and discussing solutions on the impact of climate change on health, I think it's a very, very good way forward in actually addressing climate change.
Absolutely. And with that, Mr. Prime Minister, I just want to say thank you. Malo apitosi ikau mai ke Bogolaman, and wish you all the best.
Malo apito. Thank you.
No worries. That, of course, is Tonga's Prime Minister, Siausi Sovelani, speaking to us from New Zealand. Pacific Beat. Well, this week, New Caledonia, they're hosting the 10th South Pacific Defence Ministers meeting. In attendance will be its host, French Defence Minister Sebastian Lecornu. High on the agenda of the meeting will be security, next to climate change and disaster relief. But what are France's security aspirations in the region? Joining me now is Denise Fisher, former senior Australian diplomat who served as the Australian Consul General in Noumea. With that, I say welcome and comment ça va, Denise?
Ça a l'air de très bien, merci. J'espère pour vous aussi.
Thank
you for having me on the program again, Agnes.
Yeah, as always, and we appreciate your time this morning. For those who may not even know a little bit about, the defense meeting, tell us about this and who is actually attending this year?
Yeah, well, it's a meeting that takes place every year. It's a 10-year-old concept, and this year France is hosting it. The guests are Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, PNG, Vanuatu's there, and the Chilean have sent their representative. And there's also observation. There are observers by the United States and the United Kingdom. So that the principle for participation is really those countries of the region that have substantial militaries enough to be able to cooperate, especially, as you've already mentioned, in the fields of humanitarian assistance, emergency management, that kind of thing. So it's a coordination meeting between those partners.
And I do have to ask, I mean, look, there it just seems to be this sudden upsurge of interest in the Pacific. And so, and especially around security discussions. So why is this summit important?
Well, I think the summit is important in the sense that it is a very important ongoing working group. It's sort of the coordination mechanism for some of these important activities, especially for scattered Pacific Island states like maritime surveillance. They'll be looking at interoperability of the different forces and of ways to improve the mechanisms for emergency and catastrophe management. That's the primary focus of these meetings. But as you say, there are wider issues going on in the Pacific at the moment. And I think for that reason, plus for a local domestic reason, this particular meeting is of some interest, or should be, to our regional partners.
Can I ask, Denise, why security, though, when often we are hearing, COP28 has just finished, climate change and its impacts seem to be more of a concern?
Well, certainly in the Pacific context, it is the real effects of climate change that need to be addressed, and the functioning of our defence forces in the region across all these partners is focused very much on that because of the impact on the islands. So that is a real concern. But there is also the wider concern of who those partners are. And it's an interesting group, isn't it, to see Chile involved, for example, from Easter Island. It's a presence there in Easter Island. But particularly for France, I think this is a very interesting time for the region in terms of calibrating the allies that participate, especially as we're all aware that there's a greater presence and influence of China. The United States has recalibrated its presence. It's interesting that they're there as an observer this time. But I think also the whole aspect of France's participation is of interest. I think it's really encouraging and reassuring that France is participating in this way, on the one hand, to host this meeting. So I don't think there's any doubt about that, although there are some ambiguities. You know, France didn't participate in Mr. Biden's initiative, for example, for the four maritime Blue Pacific Partnership that it launched a couple of years ago. France declined to participate in that. So I think there are questions in regional minds as to just how France sees its role. Mr. Macron, in defining the Indo-Pacific vision for France, has situated France a little bit differently. He seems to be talking about the United States and China as separate allies, France will separate presences in the region, and that France would offer a third option. Well, I think there have been questions about that. Does France see the United States in the same way as sees China? Is France, where does that position France in the Western Alliance in the Pacific? So there are all sorts of questions about that. So France hosting this meeting, I think, is reassuring. It wants to be participating. But then there is a related aspect that I think would feed a few, at least disquiet amongst some of the members of this meeting this time, about the timing of the visit and the location of the visit. You know, Mr. Macron has defined his Indo-Pacific vision in terms of its sovereignty in the two oceans. And of course, Noumea, New Caledonia, is one of its preeminent overseas territories. But it is precisely in New Caledonia where this territorial sovereignty is being challenged and is not yet fully resolved. So I think, you know, the more alert members of this group would be aware that the day they arrived, there was a large demonstration 1,500 large in Pacific terms by independent supporters, indigenous Kanak independence supporters, from the Mwaka, the sacred totem pole, to the Place des Cocotiers, where they were protesting against the militarization of New Caledonia. So there are some disquieting messages, and I think some leaders around the table may be wondering whether France has been seeking to draw them into this in reaffirming France's sovereignty at a time when this is not fully resolved in New Caledonia. So I think there would be some kind of discomfort on the part of some of these governments that are participating.
Yeah, such a good breakdown of that. Thank you, Denise. Look, before we get into France's security aspirations in the region and even the Canucks and their response, you did mention, and I just want to roll back a bit about those who are participating as just observers. Can you elaborate as to, does that mean then they can only watch, they have no voice to
Yes, that's what observership usually means. They can participate and watch. But as I said earlier, the essence of this meeting is for on-ground operations amongst defence forces in the region who regularly participate in things like dealing with, the results of a cyclone, for example. You obviously need major military materiel to help in those circumstances. And so while those other countries, well, certainly the United Kingdom doesn't have any role there, the United States does, but in the Northern Pacific, but in the Southern Pacific, it is basically those countries who are present in New Caledonia who are active in those areas. I don't think it's an accident that the United Kingdom and the Australia and UK are observers when we have this new AUKUS agreement between United Kingdom, those two countries, and Australia. I think there is in the background there's some kind of awareness of the, and reinforcement of the this new partnership to improve the fundamental security of the Western Alliance. There's no doubt about that.
So then now we come forward to, the Kanak community. I know you alluded to it a little bit, but do you probably think they're not too happy about this?
I don't believe they are. I think the timing for them, I believe, we in the Pacific are polite when visitors come to our country. And I think for independence supporters to go out on the streets on the day when all these senior leaders arrive, it's no accident. It's not something that is done without a lot of forethought. So I do believe that they are wanting a message to be sent to these participants. I do.
Yeah. And so, Denise, finally, when moving forward again, what can we expect? What are the major outcomes from this meeting?
Oh, I think undoubtedly it's going to be greater efficiency and collaboration. The groundwork is already there. I think the region has a very good record in terms of defence cooperation and coordination around this kind of support role in the region, both not just in managing catastrophes and so on, but in intelligence sharing, fisheries surveillance, illegal fisheries surveillance, all kinds of scientific surveillance and remote sensing. It's very important that the complex coordination of different defence forces be coordinated on a regular basis. So the outcomes of this meeting are no doubt very positive from that perspective.
Denise, it is always great to catch up with you. Just want to say a big merci beaucoup, and hopefully we can catch again, and we will keep our eyes and ears on this defence meeting.
Thank you very much, Agnes. Bye.
No worries. That is former Australian Consul General in Noumea, Denise Fisher, here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Bobby McCumber, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBole. Well, a first-of-its-kind protest against deep-sea mining in international waters has ended with activists ordered to abandon an exploration vessel. The company conducting mining exploration says the activists were being reckless and getting in the way of important scientific work. But the protesters say the court ruling was a massive own goal for the mining company. Marion Farr with this report.
Way out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, far from land, a heated disagreement broke out.
We had five climbers who scaled the crane at the back of their ship.
And then eventually they boarded the vessel and sat on top of our A-frame, which meant that we couldn't safely operate it. So it brought the science to a grinding halt.
At that point, when we had an ongoing occupation, which was the first ever occupation of a deep sea mining industry ship at sea,
we were left with no option but to go to the courts to seek an injunction on their reckless behaviour.
Greenpeace activists were protesting against deep-sea mining exploration in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone.
It is continental in size, and it is the area that this new dangerous industry, deep-sea mining, wants to get its monster machines into kilometres below the surface of the waves.
Louisa Casson is one of the protesters.
So far, this industry has always tried to operate out of sight, out of mind. And that's why we have deployed one of our Greenpeace ships to come out here to bear witness to what the metals company was doing.
The metals company is a Canadian resource group that has been leading the push towards mining the deepest parts of the ocean. They want to extract small rocks known as polymetallic nodules, which contain precious metals like copper, cobalt, and nickel. At this stage, the practice has not been approved on a commercial scale, but the metals company CEO, Jared Barron, wants that to change. His company is pushing ahead with the backing of the Nauru government.
You know, our plan is still to be in commercial production pending the approval to do so by the end of 2025.
But in order to get there, the company needs to conduct research and exploration.
Last year, we spent 6 months at sea collecting these very same rocks. We had a scientific expedition where we went out and surveyed the area extensively.
Jared Barron says scientists returned to the zone last month to study the impact.
This visit, Campaign 8 as we know it, it is about our 20th campaign, is all about looking at how the area is recovering 12 months after we were collecting rocks from our license area.
But it wasn't all smooth sailing. Midway through the expedition, Greenpeace activists arrived.
At first it was peaceful. They were in kayaks, you know, holding up signs, and that's fine. But then they started to really interfere with us being able to launch our scientific equipment into the water. And then eventually they boarded the vessel and sat on top of our A-frame, which meant that we couldn't safely operate it. So it brought the science to a grinding halt.
Last week, the metals company took legal action against Greenpeace, seeking an injunction to stop the protest. The case was heard in the District Court of Amsterdam, where the Greenpeace boat is registered.
And we were happy to see that the court did order them off the vessel.
Jared Barron says the behaviour was reckless and dangerous.
At a time when the world is saying we need more science, we had Greenpeace turn up and do everything they could to prevent us collecting that data.
But it wasn't a complete success for the metals company. It wanted the protesters banned from going within 500 metres of their research ship, but the court refused, allowing activists to remain close by. Protesters held up signs saying, "Legally, still here." Greenpeace campaigner Louisa Casson says the court's ruling was an own goal for the mining company.
While our climbers who had scaled the crane of the ship had to come down, the protest continued, and it was actually a landmark ruling in support of peaceful protest, recognising the huge social importance of this issue of deep sea mining.
The activist group believes deep sea mining risks irreparably harming the ocean environment.
Greenpeace really wanted to shine a light on this. You know, we know this is hugely controversial, not just to us, but to fishing communities, to human rights groups, to a growing number of governments, nearly 25 governments who are calling for a halt on this industry.
Louisa Casson believes the protest was a huge success.
I think it really showed that just two kayaks, three boats, five climbers can really rock this industry to the core. It really showed the fragility of this industry.
But the metals company CEO, Gerard Barron, doesn't see it that way.
In their dreams. I mean, it was a nuisance. And I guess what it did do is give everyone a little bit of a wake-up call to just how far some of these very radical organizations will go.
For now, the Greenpeace ship has left the area and is on its way back to New Mexico. And although the clash may have simmered down for now, neither party is giving up on its fight.
We've got a very dedicated team of scientists on board the research vessel. They're representing many independent, world-class scientific organizations who are involved in our science research program. And all they want to do is the science.
So the momentum really continues all across the world. You know, in the last year, we have tripled the number of governments who are opposing this industry.
And that is a report by Marion Farr.
Pacific Beat.
Now, an alarming increase in new HIV infections in Papua New Guinea has people scrambling to resuscitate dormant programs to prevent the spread of the disease. After the country successfully contained what some feared would be a catastrophic epidemic of the human immune deficiency virus in the 2000s, the number of new infections has nearly doubled in just a year. Liam Fox reports.
Tony Lupiwa, the acting director of the National AIDS Council Secretariat, is worried. Very worried.
It's very alarming for us. We were expecting a small increase, but this big increase is making us panic a bit because that's a lot within 1 year space.
The big increase he's referring to is the number of new HIV infections recorded last year compared to 2021.
It has climbed up to 6,500 new cases for 2022. And that's an increase from 3,400 cases.
That works out to be 18 people testing positive to HIV per day last year, compared to just 10 new infections a day the year before. That's nearly a doubling of the rate of new infections in just a year. As alarming as that is, Dr. Anne Clark from the group Businesses for Health says the picture is even worse when you go back further and look at other statistics.
For example, if we go back to 2018, more than 500,000 tests were conducted. Last year, only 100,000 tests were conducted. You've got a catastrophic drop-off in the number of people being tested. What we've seen is an increase in the number of babies being born and diagnosed with HIV because less than a fifth of all mothers are offered an HIV test prior to birth. So we had 820 babies diagnosed with HIV last year.
So what's behind the dramatic increases? Tony Lupiwa from the National AIDS Council Secretariat says the push to prevent the spread of HIV has collapsed in recent years.
We haven't been doing prevention work in terms of awareness, advocacy and distribution of condoms and other material for people to use to protect themselves.
Where once HIV was a major public health issue in PNG, Mr. Lupiwa says it has all but disappeared from the national consciousness.
There hasn't been very much in the newspapers in the last 4 years, and the radio and TV. So maybe people thought that HIV is gone and they've gone back to the risky behaviour.
And what's the reason for that? Money, or rather the lack of it.
It's been a tough 4 years for us because there hasn't been enough funding to cater for prevention work around the country.
And is that because of COVID, that attention was shifted that way and also resources were shifted towards COVID?
Yeah. COVID got all the attention in the last 2 years. That's one of the reasons why the resources and attention was to COVID and not to HIV.
Dr. Anne Clark puts it a little more bluntly.
In 2010, when we thought we were at the peak of the HIV crisis in PNG, where we saw better access to testing and treatment, we went, oh, that's cool. And the rest of the wealthy world went, oh, they've got testing, they've got treatment, she'll be right, mate. COVID just put another nail in the coffin.
The result, she says, has been the total devastation of HIV prevention efforts in PNG. Mr. Lupiwa, though, is hopeful the situation can be turned around.
Both the Health Department and the National AIDS Council have been working on the new strategy, and we are going to launch it in the beginning of next year. The priority is prevention. We are hoping that the government and our donor and development partners will support us in implementing that strategy.
Dr. Clark says it's time local authorities and international donors took a more holistic approach to health development.
When donor funding comes in, quite often it's put in a bucket for that and a bucket for this. We need to get cleverer about something as basic as safe sex should be absolutely part of primary school, high school, university, workplace programming, where people can talk confidently and comfortably about their rights to sexual health.
And that's Dr. Anne Clark from Businesses for Health, ending that report from Liam Fox. Stay tuned, because up next is NewsWrap with producer Carl Evans.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend. In the Fale, Fridays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Yes, it is time for our news wrap, but it is brought by producer Carly Evans. With that, I say a good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning to you, Aggie. I am well. One more day until Friday.
Yes, always closer to the weekend is good news for me. We do start off with some very concerning news. The son of Fiji's former Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, he's now faced court over fresh domestic violence charges.
Yeah, that's right. So the Sydney Morning Herald has reported that Meli Bainimarama was arrested in Sydney on Monday and charged with intentionally choking a person, assault, as well as property damage. So it's alleged that shortly after 3 a.m. He damaged a woman's Nissan car key, then assaulted her and intentionally choked her. He was then arrested, taken to Grenville Police Station and refused bail. He's since faced court in Parramatta in Western Sydney on Monday and has pleaded not guilty to these fresh charges. And look, bear in mind, all this is on top of a raft of other domestic charges which are still pending, in which police alleged that he choked a bit and hit a woman and recorded a video without consent. The hearing for those charges have been adjourned until April next year. So,
goodness.
Yeah, a bit going on.
Yeah, so unfortunate with that incident. As we remember, we spoke about the high levels of domestic violence in Fiji and knowing someone like this.
Mm.
Yeah, crazy, crazy. Guam, though, they're exploring the possibility of sending prison inmates to Saipan, was it?
Yeah, a bit of an interesting one. So the Pacific Daily News has reported that Guam officials began talks in Saipan yesterday, and they've come about due to a lack of space within Guam's prison facilities. So Guam's prison was only built to house 300 inmates, but at the moment, the island currently has an inmate population of about 850. Saipan's correction facility, meanwhile, was built to accommodate a little more than 500 inmates, but it only currently has two inmates currently staying there. So, yeah, a bit of a win-win situation for both places at a glance.
Yeah, if we look at it that way, I'm just sure it's a win-win situation. But are there any details around how many inmates would actually be sent to Saipan and even the cost?
No, so that was put to officials, but they said it was premature to provide those details since the discussions are still just starting out. But they did say sending some inmates to Saipan would only be a temporary solution, with the long-term solution ultimately expanding Guam's current facility. However, it is understood that if it goes ahead, the Northern Marianas could expect to receive a revenue of almost $5 million if it agrees. Ooh. So, yeah, a bit of a sweetener there.
Yeah, right. We head to PNG, though, because Prime Minister
Minister James Marape is travelling to Australia today to sign that long-awaited security deal.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm reading that Australian police officers will form a central part of that deal. Outlets are reporting that up to 50 Australian police will take up key positions within PNG's police force and pave the way for PNG to take on greater peacekeeping duties. Details other than that are scarce, but obviously, as Tim Swanson so expertly reported on this show a number of times, defence and internal policing will form a major part of the agreement, assisting farmers to meet Australia's biosecurity rules will form a part of the deal as well, I understand.
Yeah, nice. Look, and just quickly, do we have an update on Cyclone Jasper?
Yes, so the bomb's latest reports show it is currently hovering over the Coral Sea, about 400 kilometres southwest of the Solomon Islands. It's moving southwestward towards Australia and is expected to keep tracking that way over the next 3 days. Models show it could be a Category 5 system by tonight and is heading towards the North Queensland coast, somewhere between Townsville and Cairns. So good news is there are reports that expect it to weaken before it hits the coast early next week.
That's exactly what we want to hear. Look, as always, thank you, Kyle, for bringing our news wrap.
Thank you, Aggie.
Pacific Beat. Well, tensions have risen as New Zealand's newly elected Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, alongside his coalition parties ACT and New Zealand First, have released policies that essentially will somehow dial back the usage of even the country's official languages, te reo. There's also plans also to scrap anti-smoking legislation and the Māori Health Authority. This sparked nationwide protests from the community organised by Te Pāti Māori. So how did it go? And what is this political party hoping will happen from these protests? Well, joining us live this morning as co-leader of Te Pāti Māori, it is Debbie Ngārewa Peka. With that, I say morena, Debbie.
Morena.
Always great to catch up, and I really appreciate the first time we've been able to discuss here on ABC Pacific. I want to ask, well, actually congratulate, before we get to the protest, there were some big gains for your party on the two new MPs. That now makes six in total, correct, from Te Pāti Māori? I mean, how proud are you of these achievements?
I was super proud. I mean, we are the only Indigenous party, and we were the only party that stood up against quite an extreme right wing leaning this election. So we're really proud, and I guess it shows that, you know, our people don't support the way that the government's going, and they gave us that unanimous support. So extremely humbled and proud.
Yeah, awesome. Debbie, what was really interesting as I watched this unfold on my social media, you know, what was surprising was that Prime Minister Chris Luxon himself not really knowing anything about the protests. Was that a surprise for you?
Yeah. No, it's not too surprising. The Prime Minister, current first term Member of Parliament, actually, last 2020, and first term Prime Minister, obviously, hasn't got a strong record with Māori, hasn't been involved in Māori communities' activities, hasn't really been a part of advancing any kaupapa. So he's still got to be inducted into understanding 20% of the population who make up our tangata whenua, taking on board that we also have our important tuakana, our Pasifika relations. And so, yeah, he would be what I would class as extremely ignorant on Māori aspirations of politics.
Yeah, and when we think about policies that have been part of this new government's 100-day plan, even to hear the removal of te reo from government agencies, I mean, does this actually paint the government as racist?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, and it's not, I mean, if you didn't want to have a view from those who are affected as tangata whenua, those of our Pacifica communities, I mean, they don't even have a Pacifica member within the whole party, but also the amount of tangata tiriti, those of our non-Māori who stood with us, are extremely concerned about what it is that they're dialing back, what the impact on those of us as a nation who are barely addressing the inequities. As Indigenous people, you know, and you probably know, we are the highest incarcerated. We are the dying 7 to 10 years earlier than non-Māori. Educationally, we're failing because we are, you know, locked in systems that were designed for European, designed by Victorian England, and they haven't been designed in consideration of where this whenua is in tangata whenua. So, yeah, it's really concerning about how far they're prepared to dial us back. But, you know, I said in the House yesterday, this hatred and this anti-Māori sentiment is being met with some of the most staunchest resistance. So where we see this going is that we first of all call ourselves together. We call ourselves to stand up against any racism, doesn't matter which race it is, but also make sure that we show the government, as we did anti-apartheid, as we did anti-nuclear, as we did with women's votes. It's always been activism in Aotearoa. And we've got a greenhorn Prime Minister who's getting his first shot of what tangata whenua can achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about the fact that, you know, currently 5,000 New Zealanders die from the harms of tobacco-related illnesses every year. Again, we know that Māori Pacific have the highest smoking rates. But the government want to repeal the Smoke-Free Act. I mean, at the end of the day, who wins, who loses?
Well, you know, it's actually a little bit more sinister than that, if it was just that. But actually what they want to do is dial it back so that they can give tax cuts to their rich mates. And I think that's what we're captured in, and we're seeing this across the world. We're captured in a moment in time when those who participate in democracy, don't forget we had over 1 million in Aotearoa who didn't vote. You know, like nearly 20%+ didn't vote, participate in our so-called democracy system. The actual democratic system on election day had massive failures with electronic, you know, access and things. But the reality is that we have to remind ourselves again that the smoking is, and lung cancer is, our highest, as you said, cause of death. It's an avoidable. 3 times more Māori and Pacifica die from this. It is an avoidable solution, an avoidable deaths. We have solutions. We need to follow through for them. But you know, again, it's, and I guess, you know, in a really direct way, I want to say to you, it is like watching the manifesto of the colonizers in 1840. And I know for some that sounds extreme, but they, you know, we've had sponsored state terrorism in Aotearoa. I come from Taranaki, from Parihaka, and we have seen this before, and it's truly revolting. It's truly revolting to see it getting so much power in 2023. So thankfully we've got 70% of our populations are under the age of 40, and there is a resistance that they have never seen. I just think that this Prime Minister's bitten off more than he can chew, and if he wants to be more than a one-term Prime Minister, he's going to have to dial it back. But we've got a bit of resistance to do yet.
And I don't want to rehash this, but, you know, I have to, this came across on Insta was, you know, New Zealand First MP Shane Jones saying that you operate from a platform of victimhood. Well, what really is your response to that?
I mean, you know, Shane's actually got Waka Papa, but he's in a party, a Pākehā-driven party that does not have the best interests of Māori at heart. We are survivors of colonisation, and we are anything but victims. And I guess, you know, that's that sort of shaming that's going on. We've nicknamed him Shame Jones, by the way. But that's that shaming going on to try and justify and deflect from the harm that they're doing. And we just got to, like, ignore. You know, we've got a couple of grumpy old uncles in Parliament, and you've just got to ignore them and just stay aspirational and, you know, stay connected to reminding ourselves that we are not the problem waiting to be punished. We are tangata whenua. We are beautiful. Our mokopuna are beautiful. My mokopuna are Māori and Pacifica. They are the best mokos in the world, by the way. And we just have to stay focused on what a futuristic Aotearoa needs to look like. And it's not this that we're seeing at the moment. And we said yesterday in the House, stay positive, stay united, stay focused on what is good about us, and keep saying it to yourself and to everyone else.
Yeah, and talking about staying united, Toitū te Tiriti. Of course, it was a nationwide action day. Debbie, are you aware of how many actually across the country participated? Again, what was the intentions, and do you believe you accomplished what you wanted?
Oh, absolutely. I think our intention was first and foremost to give rise to our people and to hear ourselves and be ourselves, and to never ever feel that you're alone in this that's going on. I come from an electorate that is huge. It's probably equal to about 39 general seats. There are at least 10,000 across my electorate. So, and again, we had 20 sites. There was, you know, an average of, you know, 500 to 700 in some of the small sites. The cities were just huge. They had thousands. So I don't know. And you know what's really great is that, you know, we went into this with 72 hours notice. We didn't know if we'd have six people turn up. And that's, I guess, that's what's so unique about Te Pāti Māori. We don't get media. We don't get press. We are an Indigenous, you know, unapologetic Indigenous voice. And we rely, truly rely on social media and our relationships, our wanangatanga. And I think if that's what we can do in 72 hours, wait for the next.
Yeah, which might be really a good encouragement, obviously, when we think about First Nations here in Australia. Moving, and I know you're well aware of that, but moving forward, what are the next steps for Te Pāti Māori?
Our next steps are, yeah, obviously, the house opened up yesterday, so our next steps is to stand as a tira, stand and stand united in the house, cover that, hold these politicians and this, you know, revolting government to account. The second thing is to continue to grow the movement outside of us, and there will be a series of events and triggers that will be given very quick notice to continuously grow and disrupt the thinking. You know, we have a huge Māori economy, and so far we've been really humble and not, I guess, not triggered some of the other reactions that could really affect this government. So at the moment, it's like carrying on with the activism and giving notice that you are only going to get away with so much, and then we are going to, you know, stop things even worse than we did the other day. So we're just, we're just going to stay focused on what it is that we're here to do.
Yeah, and look, we wish you well, Debbie. We appreciate your time morning. Thank you so much for joining our show. No worries.
Anytime. Thank you, Deb.
Ngā mihi. That is co-leader of Te Pāti Māori, Debbie Ngāriwa Packer, speaking to us from Aotearoa. Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. For more on any of our stories, what you need to do is simply head to abc.net.au/Pacific, and you can hear us again this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time. But remember, tomorrow will be our sports edition with Richard Ewart at 6 a.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. But I do have to say, I'm signing off for 2023. I will see you in 2024. Again, I'm Aggie Tupou, and this is Pacific Beat.